We turn now to a topic we cover often here on The Morning Show, and that's the war on drugs. Over the last few weeks, I've been lucky enough to lecture to university students at public and private universities throughout the tri-state area about the drug war. And after going through the history of the failures of the drug war to meet its own goals, I've been ending those classes by asking the students, why then, in the face of such failure, does the drug war continue? To get at this question, I ask them, who benefits from the drug war? Now, a powerful new book is beginning to answer this question in a much more comprehensive way. It's called Drug War Capitalism, published just last month by AK Press. We're joined now by the author of Drug War Capitalism, Don Paley, who's a journalist from Vancouver, British Columbia. Don's written for numerous publications in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Mexico. Don Paley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Christy.
Of course. So first, let's get to the central concept in this book. What is this special form of capitalist expansion driven by the drug war? What is drug war capitalism?
Well, drug war capitalism is the title of my new book, and it's an idea that I've been thinking about writing about for the last few years. Basically, I argue that things like Plan Colombia and the Merit Initiative, which are big U.S.-financed initiatives to supposedly stop the flow of drugs to the United States, are actually failing, as we know and as you've mentioned, to stop the flow of drugs, but they're succeeding in other ways. They're succeeding in reforming and changing legal systems and laws to encourage foreign direct investment. They're encouraging militarization and, you know, the protection of mining and oil and all kinds of different corporate interests by newly trained police with fancy new U.S. weapons. And that process of militarization, I argue in the book, also leads to a process of paramilitarization where the people who are moving drugs also then arm themselves in order to sort of protect their business. And I look at Colombia as a way to talk about how that process of paramilitarization has also proved to be useful to the, you know, big transnational capital interests. So that's kind of the main breakdown of what drug war capitalism is.
Right. Wow. So you really have the drug war really paving the way for these new kinds of capitalist expansion. And in the book, you have this really interesting moment, I think, where you're talking to a Mexican activist and she says something like, oh, have you heard of the shock doctrine? It's just that the shock didn't work here in Mexico. So what's the relationship between Naomi Klein's idea of shock doctrine and your new idea of drug war capitalism?
Well, I think they're certainly linked in a way. In that beginning part where I have Raquel Gutierrez, who's an amazing activist in Mexico, talking about, you know, the shocks didn't work. It was basically saying, like, NAFTA wasn't enough. Mm. There was still all these big public companies in Mexico after NAFTA, including the now privatized state oil company. And there's a lot of communally owned land, and there's, like, a lot of Mexicans who own businesses and who aren't dependent on, you know, U.S. corporations for example, their food or for work or what have you. And so I argue that what has happened with the drug war in Mexico is kind of like a second round or like a NAFTA plus NAFTA with guns. And, you know, in the sense that the initial shocks that happened and then NAFTA happened and the drug war is like another big prolonged shock that's being applied in Mexico.
Right. Wow. So one of the really crucial things that you do in the book is try to break down the barrier between the state and the cartels, the legal and the illegal, kind of the licit and illicit money being made off of the drug trade. How have these two sides sort of become one in the drug war?
Well, I mean, when you look at, for example, who these supposed drug cartels are, drug gangs are, they're often made up of former police, special forces, of people trained by the state. And they're often working, you know, either directly with or in complicity with or at least paying off, you know, local authorities and state-level authorities and federal-level authorities. And there's been a couple of cases recently where what we've been seeing is just the level of participation by state forces and a lot of the violence and a lot of the illicit activities. For example, the kidnapping of the 43 students and their disappearance in Guerrero. Those students were detained initially by municipal police and then supposedly handed off to a drug gang. Well, I would call them more like a paramilitary group who it looks like has, you know, for sure at least murdered one of the students, but, you know, they're looking for the other 43 students. But these kind of events are happening with more frequency where we're seeing that, you know, the perpetrators of many of the crimes in the drug war, the massacres, either are currently employed by the state, you know, their police or army, their former state forces, or at minimum, they're sort of supervised by government forces.
Right.
So it's very difficult to separate out and say, you know, it's a state narrative to say, well, those are the bad guys, the criminals, the drug cartels. Mm. We're the good guys. We're fighting them. The reality is a lot more gray than that.
Right. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how U.S. militarization, first under Plan Colombia and then the Merida Initiative and what's going on in Central America, of course, as well, have contributed to this idea of drug war capitalism. You open the book in this small Colombian town of Santo Domingo. Maybe you can tell us what happened in Santo Domingo and how it tells this story of what militarization has done.
Sure. Santo Domingo was the site of a massacre in the late 90s. It's known that there was U.S. pilots participating in a bombing of the town where 17 people were killed. And those planes that actually dropped the bombs had left from an Occidental Petroleum oil facility, so a U.S. oil company facility not far away. The pretext at the time was that they were they had said that there was guerrillas in the town, and the U.S. pilots were saying, well, those are actually just they're guerrillas just as civilians, bomb them, etc. Mm. This huge bombing in this little tiny town. And I went to investigate that bombing just because, you know, it was clear that U.S. oil companies also had a really strong role. And this has been documented by, you know, various like international courts and so on. And I actually didn't learn until I got there that the bombing is still continuing. So This is a region where, you know, Plan Colombia took place. And there was fumigations, and there was all different kinds of these U.S.-backed programs happening all over, and, you know, supposedly to eradicate drugs. And what you have is Plan Colombia is now over, and you have the same community still being bombed with cluster bombs from the air on the pretext, again, of, you know, fighting the guerrillas and making things safe for the people in the area, which doesn't make sense because, you know, how are you making people safe when you're actually bombing them?
Right.
And what the people there told me is, like, they're attacking us because there's oil under, you know, under the earth here where we live. And to me, it was a really powerful statement coming from folks in these communities saying, like, directly, like, we are being attacked because they want our oil. You know, Plan Colombia did not change anything for them. In fact, it likely made things worse. And the fact that, you know, these bombing campaigns continue in Colombia is something that, you know, I think is really scandalous. And unfortunately, not enough people know that the Colombian government's actually bombing its own civilians.
Wow. And so are there similar cases in Mexico? I know that in the book you talk about some of the things that people like the geographer Melissa Wright have uncovered in Ciudad Juarez, for example. Do you see similar kinds of military actions in the interest of these kinds of corporate actors in Mexico?
Well, I would say that it's something that's becoming increasingly obvious in Mexico. But there's not as many cases that are as well documented as the cases in Colombia. For example, like really where you get the good documentation is often from like the Inter-American Court or big court cases and so on. And in Mexico, it hasn't been going on for as long, so it's, you know, not as well documented. But I have cases in the book where for sure in individual cases, like federal police infiltrating community meetings or people who are supposedly belonging to a drug cartel killing anti-mining activists, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, there's also things like recently in Mexico State, there was a massacre, Tlatlaya massacre, where Mexican soldiers executed 15 people. And then they dressed it up as if it had been a firefight and said, you know, oh, well, you know, they're part of a drug cartel and we were battling with them, gun battle. But witnesses described how the people were actually lying down face down when they were shot by soldiers.
Right, and one was a teenage girl. Like, it's an unbelievable case.
And then you have the case also of Ayotzinapa, where it's, you know, again, state police who are responsible for kidnapping all these kids and their disappearance. And so making the connection in those two cases directly with resource extraction, I don't think that we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly we can look at patterns in terms of really, really harsh state repression in communities, especially indigenous communities, marginalized communities, where people are organized, and the spread of terror throughout the country as a way to, you know, ensure that people actually don't organize, to restrict people's mobility, to silence people's voices in terms of also not just, you know, their survival and their ability to, like, have good lives, but their ability to resist and to defend also their their land and their you know, own economic survival.
Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that happens, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, is this idea of paramilitarization. Now, paramilitarization is something that we know about in the case of Colombia, right? Because we're told that there are these various actors, that there are the guerrillas on one side, the paramilitaries and the state on the other side, with the U.S. there assisting. But paramilitarization is not something we typically think of in the Mexican case. But as you mentioned, because of what's going on with these missing students from the Ayotzinapa Normal School, there's more special attention focused on these police forces. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about this process of paramilitarization, what it looks like and where you're seeing it happening in Mexico.
Sure. I mean, I actually found out while I was researching this book that in the 90s, the Colombian Congress was working really hard to fight the idea that there was paramilitaries in Colombia.
Right.
They just kept on saying they're not paramilitaries, they're drug gangs, they're not paramilitaries, because when a state finally admits that there's paramilitaries, they're admitting that they're complicit, right? Or actively participating. That's the sort of definition of why it's, you know, what is a paramilitary group? It's a group that's working with the government. It's not part of the state, but it's directly connected. And like you said, examples like Ayotzinapa, where you have the police, you know, handing off students to supposedly to a drug gang. It's like, well, if they weren't working together, how did they, you know, how did they find them? And how did they, why would they give the students to them? It's just like that's become a very obvious case of the kinds of collaboration that take place between state forces and non-state forces in Mexico. And I think that, you know, one piece that we can start working on in terms of just our own discussions and like talking with our friends and thinking about what's happening in Mexico is to start to look at these drug gangs not as, you know, or drug cartels not as separate from the state and these bad guys that need to be fought, but they're actually often made up of state agents and, you know, working directly with the police and the army. And I think when we start thinking about things that way, it gives us a more accurate picture of the conflict and of the war on Mexico, which I argue in my book is a war on the people. It's not a war on drugs.
Right. And so one of the really important things that I think your book does is that it moves beyond the kind of the stories that we normally tell or that we normally hear about the drug war, you know, focused on Mexico and Colombia. And you have two chapters actually dedicated to what the consequences of the drug war have been in Central America, focusing on Guatemala and Honduras. So can you talk a little bit about how you see drug war capitalism and the drug war operating in those parts of Central America and how U.S. security policy is implicated?
Sure. I mean, the motivation for including various countries is basically to move past an idea that, like, the drug war is a problem that Mexico has, right? Or the drug war is a problem that Colombia has, and instead look at how U.S. policy is what's actually driving a lot of times the violence. You know, in all of these different countries that I looked at, the second year of funding of San Colombia, the second year of funding of the Merit Initiative, and the second year of funding of the Central America Regional Security Initiative, which is the equivalent in Central America, were, like, among the most violent years in the case of Central America in peacetime in the history of the country. And so there's these direct connections between where the U.S. money is flowing, how much, and, you know, for the militarization, and how much violence people are experiencing.
Wow.
And so in the cases of Honduras and Guatemala, it's very open, it's very overt. For example, the U.S. sent 200 Marines into Guatemala 2 years ago to fight the drug war. And, you know, I have quotes in there from you know, military people in the U.S. saying, like, it's so great we're getting back to the old days where we actually get to, like, do kind of combat-style stuff in Central America. And in Honduras, there's a, you know, the case that for a while actually got quite a bit of attention of DEA agents themselves actually being involved in shooting civilians from a helicopter and killing a handful of indigenous people in the north of Honduras. So there's a far more sort of overt participation by the U.S. and U.S. forces in Central America. And just, again, it's, I think, very similar. Like, a lot of the regions where the conflict is really intense, supposedly around the drugs, are also regions where it's known there's oil, for example.
Oh.
So, you know, over time, I think those connections will become more obvious. But the point of including various countries was to say, like, this isn't just something that's happening in Mexico because of Mexican political culture. It's like, no, actually, this book is about U.S. policy and how the drug war is actually what is fueling the violence and creating a lot of these conflicts in these various places.
Right. And so in the case of Central America, I think in your book, you also detail the interests of, and this is something, you know, we at NACLA have been covering for a while as well, the interests of, say, Canadian mining companies in Central America. And how, so can you talk just a little bit more? I mean, I know that we're kind of beginning to see this transition, but about the capitalism aspect, have there been the changes to the laws or, you know, moving in extractive industries and that sort of thing in Central America in the same way that you've been able to look at trace in Colombia and that you're starting to see in Mexico as well?
Well, I think it's a little bit different because, for example, in Guatemala, but also in Honduras, both of those countries were opened up a lot more severely and a lot deeply in terms of protectionism and in terms of their own local economies than Mexico was. So
right.
Mexico, as I mentioned, still had, you know, a state-owned oil company, you know, still has a lot of Mexican-owned businesses and so on. And, you know, in places like Honduras, the elite is fully transnational and, you know, there's very few laws, especially after the coup in 2009, protecting Hondurans or Honduran, you know, businesses or economies and so on. But certainly on the military side, you see it very strongly. Regions where, you know, like El Estor in Guatemala, there's a new military base right there. The pretext is, you know, we need more soldiers to fight the drug war. The reality is that, like, local people have told me, and, you know, like, we know that this military base or that the presence of more soldiers is actually to prevent us from organizing. And I think, you know, these countries have really different histories. So people in Guatemala, like, just to see a soldier is actually, like, bringing back a lot of trauma for
right,
people.
Right, of course.
You know, like, to have soldiers, and they're actually not supposed to be at all involved in any kind of civilian affairs in Guatemala after the peace accords were signed in 1996. So it's I would say, like, for me, in the experience of writing the book, Central America is, like, a very, very harsh example, almost like an image of the future. In terms of how repressive things, you know, can get and how militarized and also paramilitarized if you look at sort of gangs as a kind of another form of paramilitarism. It's a scary situation. And again, I try to use or feature the voices of people who are, you know, resisting all of these things very bravely and who are survivors as well.
Right.
Of various kinds of violence, and sort of contrast their experience of what's going on with what we're being told by officials is happening. And the contrast is pretty powerful, I think, and that's sort of, I guess, part of what motivated the book as well.
We're speaking to Dawn Paley, author of the new book, Drug War Capitalism, out just last month on AK Press. So, Dawn, you write in your conclusion about the recent passage of new neoliberal reforms in Mexico, particularly around the energy sector, and note that it's not a coincidence that these reforms came on the heels of 6 years of massive violence and displacement. You know, we know those statistics, over 100,000 dead, more than 20,000 disappeared in Mexico. And, you know, of course, when these reforms were introduced in the legislature, there were massive street protests in Mexico City while they were being considered. But as you write, they were pushed through the legislature very quickly. But now that the protests have grown in the wake of the Ayotzinapa massacre, people are really beginning to link neoliberalization to the drug war and what activists are starting to call the narco state, the narco estado. So what do you think about this growing movement, about the way that people continue to come into the streets in Mexico around Ayotzinapa, and what should happen next in Mexico?
Well, certainly what's happened in the wake of Ayotzinapa has been unprecedented. It's been really exciting. I've been in Mexico for most of that time. It's the first time where I really feel like on a national level, because demonstrations have been taking place all over the country, where people who are not directly affected by the drug war are standing up and saying this is, like, unacceptable. We are protesting this whole model, because, you know, there has been movements, as, you know, Javier Sicilia's movement, Movement for Peace and Justice and Dignity, and then of course movements of family members of people disappeared, you know, for years have been organizing and trying to bring attention to these cases with very little success, actually, in the sense of it becoming a national issue. And with Ayotzinapa, it's like people in Puebla, where I live, where, you know, it's been relatively peaceful, there hasn't been as much violence, are going out in the tens of thousands into the streets to protest. And one of the slogans in the marches has been, it wasn't the narcos that kidnapped, that disappeared the students, it was the state.
Right.
And that difference and that clarity among the public is something that's like really, really powerful. Another interesting piece with Ayotzinapa, and this is a bit of a contrast with the protests that were happening around the energy sector reform. The protests around the oil tended to be very linked to a political party, right?
Right.
With a, you know, the leader being Manuel López Obrador, and you know, there being this idea of like the PRD, the sort of left wing party, or Morena, you know, are good vehicles through which to continue organizing. And what's been happening after Ayotzinapa is that no party has really been able to profile themselves as being, you know, an acceptable option, because people see all of the parties as being, complicit.
Right, and we're seeing the kind of total dissolution of the PRD right now, right? The PRD is falling apart. Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas has walked away from the party that he founded in the late 80s. And so, yeah, the idea that all of these parties are imbricated, I think, has been a really important part of these protests. But so what do you think that meant? What do you think that means for what the politics will look like moving forward from this moment in Mexico?
It's really hard to say, but I think, you know, right now we might be in a period that could be considered a lull in terms of the street mobilizations around Ayotzinapa. But I think that that's also a sign that there's real organizing taking place, that there's people, you know, there's consolidation among various activist groups who will not let their energy be channeled into elections. So I think we can expect to see a lot more street demonstrations, a lot more really good analysis coming out from Mexico about the situation there. And, you know, hopefully like a lot more just autonomous organizing, people supporting each other, and also just raising this up and going, you know, it's not just the 43 students. We're talking about a total of disappeared in Mexico, over 42,000 people.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, over 150,000 homicides in the last 7 years. This is a national emergency crisis situation where the state has very little legitimacy in the eyes of the people on the streets. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but I feel like it's a very significant time in Mexico. It's a very exciting time at the same time that it's also a scary time, you know, because people, a lot of the signs that people hold will say, like, am I next?
Right.
You know, am I the next person that's going to get picked up by the police and disappeared? It's kind of, as students in Puebla, I'm studying there, and one of the things that was coming up in our assemblies was, like, if we don't protest against this, we're dead.
Right.
You know,
so I want to pick up on that really, just a little bit. I just want to ask, you know, because obviously we know that a number of Mexican journalists who have been covering the drug war, people like Anabel Hernandez and people of that ilk, have received serious death threats for their work and the work they've done to uncover the links of the narcos to the state to really construct this narco estado that we know about now. So you mentioned that you're in a PhD program there in Puebla, and now you've written this book. Are you facing any kind of pushback from the state? Are you in any danger for doing this work? And I know that your doctoral work is about this as well, right? And about the kind of clandestine graves that have been turned up. So are you in any danger from doing this work?
Not that I know of, but I hope not. I mean, one thing that is important to keep in mind is that, like, I'm a Canadian, you know,
right.
So foreign journalists have not really been targeted. The one example that we're all aware of is Bradley Will, who was murdered in Oaxaca in 2006 during street protests.
Right.
But certainly most of the journalists, I mean, the majority who have been targeted in Mexico are people who are writing about police. I think it's important that we also start to reframe a lot of those killings, not as being cartels who, I mean, cartels have no interest in killing journalists. It's the state, right, who has been, you know, or various pieces of the state repressive apparatus who have an interest in making sure that the stories that these journalists are able to tell don't get told about how those very same state agents are involved in, you know, XYZ corruption, drug dealing, what have you. But myself, I've so far, knock wood, things have been pretty chill.